Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to History in Technicolor with me, Wolf O'Neill, and
me, David Crowther.
And David, we're here today to talk about Zulu, the famous 1964 film.
Famous, iconic. I do have something that I'm going to try to do today, Wolf, by the way, just before we start. I'm conscious that I always shout. It's a bit like giving a mobile phone to your aged grandfather. And they don't know what it is, and they shout into it. I've realized that I've been doing that in all these podcast programs. So I'm going to try to just talk normally, okay?
As long as you don't dampen your enthusiasm, I think that's fine.
No, I'll just do the enthusiasm in sotto voce.
Is this because you were particularly loud during the Monty Python episode?
Well, I just listen to it, and I'm yelling all the time, you know, as though I'm not sort of talking normally to a normal person. I suppose I'm not talking to a normal person. I'm talking to you, but you know what I mean?
Thank you.
I wasn't being natural. Don't mention it.
Well, I've never noticed it.
Good. Very good.
Zulu, the 1964 film, is produced and written and directed by Cy Enfield, and it depicts the Battle of Rorke's Drift, which took place between the British Army and the Zulus in 1879. In the battle, fewer than 150 men, roughly a quarter of which were wounded, managed to defend a tiny outpost from roughly 4,500 Zulu warriors. And the film picks up immediately after the infamous British defeat at Isandlwana and focuses in detail upon this last stand of the 24th Regiment. So, David, I'm sure you're thinking to yourself, why did I pick this film?
Hey, Wolf.
Uh-huh.
Something I was thinking the other day. Why did you pick this film?
Good question, and I'm glad you asked. To me, a number of films have loomed over us since we began this podcast, and perhaps none more than Zulu.
It didn't be.
It's loomed for a long time. We've talked about this maybe since day one.
I kept sitting in the shed and then over looking over my right-hand shoulder, and there would be Zulu sitting there like a large toad.
Haunting. As you've already said, it has a gigantic reputation. It seems to be beloved. It's quintessential Christmas Day, Boxing Day viewing annually.
Is that really what you watch on your Boxing Day?
I mean, I've never watched it. I'm just aware that it's associated with just television programming over the Christmas period. It could be New Year.
Is that right? We watch Paddington.
Well, I was going to say, I think that Sound of Music is like the mandatory viewing that's on every year programmed in. But I think that Zulu has a big reputation for always being on around that time. Although I think of it more as like a Sunday afternoon movie.
Yes, Sunday afternoon. Ideal for Sunday afternoon.
After a big roast?
Yes, after a big roast. Or if the one-day cricket match isn't very interesting.
I remember it vividly from when I was a child. That captivating boys' adventure type stuff. But over the years, I found myself less drawn back to rewatching it. And it's probably been a decade or so since I did. Incidentally, it was one of the most successful films in Britain at the time when it came out. And I read that it stayed in regular cinema circulation for 12 years after its release. So to sum it all up, I thought we should finally tackle this behemoth and see if it holds up.
I thought we were doing Zulu rather than Behemoth. Boom, and if you will, Tish.
Thank you, David. Well, to start us off, what did you think of the film? And how long has it been since you last viewed it?
Like you, it's been decades since I have seen the film. And I can't remember being particularly carried away by it all the way back then, to be honest. So I'm not sure. I am aware of it, like you, as being a behemoth. But for me, it's never really been that film that I'll go back to. You know, I've got a lazy afternoon. I'm more like to go back to Normal Wisdom or something like that. So it is quite a while since I've seen it. I have to say that I enjoyed it quite a lot. And I was very worried, of course, because I was going back to it and thinking, oh, it's all about colonialism and the empire and how bad we were and all that sort of thing. But actually, I found that didn't get in the way at all, which may say something about me. And I thought it, in many ways, was a very good movie. In other ways, less good, but in many ways, very good.
Okay, good. Well, and we can break down those good and bad ways.
That, Wolf, is exactly what we're here for. And I'm sure the listeners are begging to hear what those things are.
Hopefully.
So optimistic, really.
Yeah, a few of the good things. I think the cast is pretty good. There are decent and varied characters, and they are kind of drawn out over the course of the film. And that is one of the main strengths of it, that you have these unique individuals, you know, trapped in this moment. I'm not sure that it's enough of an asset to really make me remember the film compared to, say, The Magnificent Seven or The Great Escape. These were films where I remember every single minor character, and I feel invested when they start to get, you know, popped off.
Interestingly, I watched The Great Escape not that long ago for some reason. I heard it was as dull as ditch water.
No.
Sorry about that.
That feels like sacrilege.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Sorry, I'm just whipping myself now. But yeah, whatevs, I thought. Anyway, carry on. Sorry about that.
Well, let's move on.
Should we talk about Winnie the Pooh as well again?
No. Let's leave Winnie out of this. I thought the production was great. It definitely has that feel of an epic. I quite like some of the shots. I thought the use of the camera work, especially during the battle sequences, really conveyed scale and power of the moment. And then it's particularly good when you know that they didn't actually have that many extras on the film. So they only had 500 Zulu extras, and they were able to convey this scale of thousands through, you know, the work that they were doing. So that plays me. I enjoyed that. I thought the set pieces were really good. The fight sequences in general were strong. The hand-to-hand combat and choreography is maybe a bit dated now, but as it really gets going, it's a pretty enthralling film. I thought the Drakenberg Mountains were a great location, and I love the richness of the color of this film. I think it was filmed on a super Technicolor or something. Right. And just to me, even now, I mean, I guess the version I'm watching was restored, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. It's just quite a bold, beautiful image. The red uniforms against that backdrop, it looks lush. Yeah. The score is incredible.
The score is fantastic. Yes. Shall I say what I liked about it now, just to have this?
Yes, please.
We're on the positive bit before we start talking about how awful we all are. I love the space and environment, the thing that you're talking about. You know, it's absolutely fantastic. The start. And the mountains and the great bowl and all the Zulus in the middle of it. It was just incredibly atmospheric. I loved the slow build up of tension, you know, that it really takes its time. And I love that. You know, the war coming, the sense of impending doom coming closer and closer. The sense of emptiness you get, the isolation is incredible. It's really atmospheric. And, you know, how could he not love Michael Caine? Stanley Baxter reminded me a little bit, I have to say, of Captain Darling. I don't quite know. Okay. I don't quite know why. I don't know. It was his voice or something. I kept on expecting him to say, oh, I don't know, Darling, or, you know, whatever. But But yes, all those things you're talking about, the colors, the atmosphere, the music, you know, really, really good. Lots of things I don't like, but we'll talk about those later, shall we?
It's interesting that you picked up like the building tension and how you like the slow start, because that was one of the things that I was less interested in this time around. Mm-hmm. I could see that it was working, and maybe I'm just the only person who felt this way, but for me, I've seen a lot better sieges and the structure of films done in a better way. As examples, I personally prefer Assault on Precinct 13 or Night of the Living Dead, or I prefer Helm's Deep in The Two Towers. I even really enjoyed the siege in Kingdom of Heaven. And I think I just like it when it gets there a bit sooner, and then you can see them more trapped within the siege rather than it being an hour of build-up and then constant conflict. I quite like the stress and tension of when they can't get out of the situation, and you've got to try and work out how they'll finish it.
Okay, so I'm going to,
that was just me.
I'm going to 180 degrees disagree with you on that.
Okay, good.
For me, the thing that didn't work in the movie was the battle scene. It was turgid, repetitive. You're absolutely right that the killing is just completely out of date. You know, a little sort of stab and the guy falls immediately to the ground and that's it. It's all over, you know. It just didn't convince me very much. And, you know, I kept started looking at my watch and thinking, look, could somebody please kill the other one, please? And then, you know, we can all go home and see the burial scene and, you know, because it, I just, you know. Maybe it's because I knew the answer. I don't know. But that bored me.
Fair enough. And I generally do agree. It is an hour of fighting, and the scenery can't really change that much. I quite enjoyed the bit when you're inside the hospital and it gets set on fire, because that felt like a change of environment, which was good. I think these other movies that I'm referencing, because the siege takes longer, you get more ups and downs, and you can really change the pace of the movie, and they have to attempt different plans to kind of escape the siege that they're under. So I don't know.
Yeah,
we're getting off topic.
Well, no, we're talking about what's good and bad about it. It
didn't quite work for me. Just everything combined, like the hour of slow build up, and then 1 hour of fairly repetitive fighting, where I couldn't always tell who the different characters were. So there was a little bit of fodder on both sides, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so David, you've already mentioned some of the things that you like. But was there anything you didn't, well, you've already said, but anything you didn't like about the film?
There were other things. So I think it's aged, the film was also aged in the acceptability of cliches. You know, there were quite a lot of cliches in the movie, it has to be said. So the Welsh are obsessed with singing, for example. And Chard has to be an English arse, doesn't he? You know, the guy in charge. The common soldiers were a bit cool, blimey gov, ain't I got a lovely bunch of coconuts? So there's a bit of that, which, you know. I mean, sometimes, actually, I love those cliches, and they felt like a pair of warm slippers. So the gruff colour sergeant, you know, was the archetypical colour sergeant. He did exactly what you expected him to do. And I kind of rather like that, actually. But there were quite a lot of cliches.
Okay, anything else that you didn't enjoy?
There was one misstep. Well, of course, we're going to talk about endlessly about colonialism, no doubt. And there was basically, I'm going to disagree properly with everything you're going to say, although I don't know what you're going to say. But as far as the Zulus were perceived, there was one misstep at the beginning, I think, where the wits are trying to get into the carriage and get away to warn the folks at Rorke's Drift. And a Zulu warrior is stabbed and I thought that was a misstep. That kind of annoyed me. Well, why is he being stabbed? Why isn't he just told to be stopped, you know? And that felt a bit sort of the savages bit.
I completely agree, and I will be bringing that scene up again in a minute. So I have a fair amount of negatives about the film, some about historical accuracy and some about the content of the film. But we'll come to those as we move on. Just wanted to throw a few facts in there about the film production, which I thought was interesting. This was filmed in South Africa, and it was during apartheid. And I think this had a big impact upon the cast and the crew during this. It's an interesting background to the film when you consider some of the topics we'll go through later. And there were various incidents during the filming where crew members and stuntmen were barred from local establishments, or one where a local foreman assaulted a worker on the set and was fired. And I think this is something that's just worth considering, that the colonialism and imperialism and some of the aspects of racism in the movie are not totally separated from the real world in which it was being filmed. Cy Enfield, the director, was declared a communist by HUAC and had been blacklisted in Hollywood. And he moved to the UK because he couldn't get any more work. And he remained here. And that was where he, you know, this is when he went on to make this film and others, which I thought was interesting. And as probably everyone knows, this was Michael Caine's first big role. And it almost never was, because he absolutely tanked the audition.
Was that right? Did he?
Yeah. Apparently, well, so first of all, he tried to audition for the role of Hookie, but he couldn't get it. And then they got him to audition for his role. And he was so nervous, he just kind of blew the audition. And they said, sorry, we have to like fly in a couple of days and we've got no one better. We're going to cast you. And everything worked out.
It's all, well, how extraordinary, how very interesting. Did he at any point in the audition say, all I told you to do was blow the bloody doors off?
I'm gonna say no, but let's hope that he did. He did always, I think he has always claimed to this day that if the film had been made by a British director and not an American, they never would have cast him as an officer because he was Cockney.
Yeah.
On to the bigger topic. So let's dive right in. David, how did you feel about the portrayal of the Zulu?
I thought the portrayal of the Zulu was almost all the way through very good. I think you're going to disagree with me, so I should have let you go first, really. But I thought you don't see much of them. The film is about the guys in Rourke's Drifts. So you don't get a very rounded picture of them. It's the job of the film is not to give you a deep insight into Zulu society. But throughout the thing, with the exception of that one scene I mentioned, it seems to me there's very little racism and so on. So there are a few events during the film, a few occasions during the film, for example, where, you know, somebody, I think, calls them savages and he gets roasted by the South African guide. You know, quite a few times it does attack that, I think, and, you know, try not to be racist, if that's the right phrase. I don't know. So, and of course, in terms of the battle, you see the bravery of the Zulu warriors, you see the organization of the Zulu warriors. You know, this is not, you don't get a feeling of, you know, the noble savage or the hopeless savage. It's clear they're under a lot of pressure. They picked up the guns from Ezelwanda and used it, which apparently is accurate. So I felt that it was very even-handed.
Good. Fair enough.
Shoot me down.
I'm not necessarily going to disagree with that.
You're not.
I think I just want...
Come on, Wolf.
Well, I definitely will, but I think that that's a valid viewing of the film. And I went into this film thinking it was going to be worse than it was. And it was a little bit more balanced than my memory had led me to believe. But I do still have some issues with what it's doing. So first of all, kind of before I get too negative, the general point of the film is that war is hell. And that's very clear throughout. It's clearly not an anti-Zulu film. And always speaks of their bravery and skill. And, you know, how the British completely underestimated them and how there was this incredible people and an excellent army. So I do believe that there's some good intentions behind the film. But I still find myself thinking about the problems too much during it. And that's mainly because the film's called Zulu and they virtually don't feature in the film except as fodder to be mown down repeatedly by the British. If we start from the beginning with the Zulu dance scene, which is really the only time you get a chance to learn more about them and kind of see their side of the story, this quick 5 minutes, I think its aim is to show, you know, a more human side to them. They're not in a conflict at the time, so you get to see them in more of their, you know, home. And it was choreographed and performed with a high level of authenticity by the Zulu people. And it is a powerful scene, and I'd totally forgotten it was in there, and I was surprised that it existed. But my excitement dwindled pretty quickly when I realized that they would not be allowed to speak during this scene, and only Jack Hawkins would speak, and he would tell us like what they think and what they feel and what their society's like, rather than ever getting a single voice of the Zulu. Yeah, Jack Hawkins as the missionary, you know, annoyed me a little bit, waffling on about marriage traditions and how these people aren't actually too strange and they're good people. You could argue on one side that a lot of what he's saying is to the audience, and there's this kind of positive message that they're trying to get across. But I think it gets undermined through the way that it's shot and kind of what they choose to exclude from the film.
On that point, I'd say that what I thought was very good about the film, actually, although taking a point about the fact that it's called Zulu rather than Rorke's Drift, was that there's no translation of what the Zulu are saying. So you get that feeling of foreigners in a foreign land. You know, the Brits are foreigners in a foreign land, and they do not understand the language. And therefore, people have made their living there have to explain what's going on. And that adds to me to the sense of isolation and alienness of those guys at Rorke's Drift. They shouldn't be there. And for me, that is a message which is reinforced constantly, that what are we doing here is a constant refrain amongst the soldiers. So the Welsh soldier picks up the soil and says, yeah, there's no moisture in this soil. It's not like the soil back at Bala. And maybe it's a slightly corny movie, but what he's saying is, what am I doing here with this foreign soil that means nothing to me? And that is a constant theme. And for me, that's why you don't get the Zulu speaking, because it's about this alien bunch of blokes stuck in a farmhouse. For what reason?
Interesting. Okay, see, I took it as the aliens were the Zulu, this group of people who have no way of communicating to us. And I see it, there's more of a comparison, especially when you get to the singing scene. It's, oh, how, you know, how wonderful is the, you know, the Welsh singing, how, you know, sophisticated is our language and our presentation. And let's, come on, we can do this. There's 4,500 Zulu singing, but these 100 Welshmen will sing louder than them and more proudly and stronger than all of them.
You see, I took that completely the other way. But not completely the other way. What I saw it is two different traditions meeting. And the Zulu singing and the coordination and the sophistication of it and the challenge is astounding. You know, they don't mess it up. They're not overpowered by the Welsh singing Men of Harlech. That never happens. They never wipe out the singing. I mean, that is one of the best bits in the movie, is the Zulu battle challenge. It's amazing stuff when they're bang on the shields, all in unison at the time. It's just incredibly atmospheric and impressive.
Okay, so I do agree. It's a good scene, and I'm being slightly too picky. I think I'm just, when we have to, I have to fall safely on one side, I'm gonna fall on the side where I'm more cautious of what this film is doing, and there are things that I'm slightly unsure about. It's an interesting viewpoint, and I had not considered that was how it might be interpreting it, and I think it could do that. What I find strange is that they bought all these Zulus in, and they spent all this time with the Zulu people, and then they didn't really have any interest to show their side of the conflict or give them an opportunity to speak. And so to me, they're completely othered and alien. And then when you mow them down repeatedly for an hour, just killing hundreds of them, it kind of wears, and it doesn't sit so well with me. I don't find it as enjoyable. I'd quite like to see a little bit of the other side of things. And before we move on completely, during that first scene with the Zulu dancing, and again, it could be raised as like an argument that can be torn down, the woman who's there, the missionary, it's like a scene from a horror movie. she's watching, you're getting close-ups of her eyes, you can almost hear the sound of like burning fire, the soundtrack booming, and she's like, it's splendid, I know, but it's quite horrible too. She's so disgusted and frightened and affronted by these people performing this dance. And Jack Hawkins has to try and calm her down and be like, maybe you shouldn't think that they're so weird and that they're so different, because some British traditions are strange too. And just to me, if you really value these people and are so impressed by them, why do you even need to have the scene of this woman who's so frightened and then is immediately attacked, needlessly attacked by this savage Zulu who's going to try and drag her off? That scene in of itself, the attack, is completely unnecessary. And then the follow-up response when the king immediately has that man stabbed and killed is again another sign that they're savage rather than like professional and disciplined.
Okay, let me respond to that.
Okay, go.
On the stabbing thing, I do agree that the one misstep, as I've said, is where the king orders the man to be stabbed. It's quite perfectly comprehensible that the Zulu warrior tries to stop them leaving, because he might be saying, look, they're going to go and tell the guys at Rourke Drift we're on the way. But what was not appropriate was the stabbing. I do agree about that.
Yeah, but it's something about nobody stops Jack Hawkins. What I mean is, to me, it's like a classic image, the woman being rushed, picked up, thrown over the shoulder to be carried off. Jack Hawkins left, you know, unmolested. I'm like, wouldn't you try and stop both of them?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a misstep. Mr. Witt, or Miss Witt, isn't it? She is there, I think, throughout the whole film to reflect the unreasonableness of the Western attitudes, and specifically of missionaries. They play a really interesting role, the Witts, because they also provide a mirror for the hypocrisy of what's going on. So there's an occasion in the film where the missionary and a Witt and one of the soldiers remember a psalm about peace, and there they are creating war. And that has got to be very pointed. The woman Witt, the female Mrs. Witt or whatever her name is, she is there to be horrified and to reflect in her horror the way we other these people. For me, she is part of the anti-war, anti-colonialism message, which I think runs all the way through this movie.
Yep, and I can see that. I can see it being raised up, but to me, the movie is not critical enough to counterbalance that. To me, Jack Hawkins waffling on just slightly about how they're, oh, no, they're actually a good people, that's not enough of like, it doesn't really reprimand her at all for having these views.
Well, it's not a social information film. You know, you have to do your own work. This isn't an anti-colonial movie. It is one of the three themes with it. What it is an action movie. It's not there
Agreed.
To beat you over the head with anti-colonialism. It would make it a dull movie if it was.
Agreed completely. To me I wouldn't put that scene in of this woman being really affronted by the Zulu during the only scene in the movie where we have the Zulu performing. Like, they're doing a wonderful dance and it's so nice to enjoy their performance.
What's your reaction to the scene? I mean, my reaction was, this ceremony is amazing and this woman is behaving badly.
Agreed.
QED. So the film has achieved its objective.
Yes, but my point is, it raises this thought that what you're seeing is horrifying, which I had never occurred to me until the woman started saying it. And what I just want to know is, why do you need to add it?
Because for that specific reason, you juxtapose the beauty of the ceremony with the hideousness of the Western attitude towards it. It's perfect.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not the filmmaker. Maybe they weren't intending that, but that's how it came across to me.
I think that does come across, and we can move on. But I just, to me, the response from Jack Hawkins, who was meant to be the kind of slightly different viewpoint, the more balanced viewpoint, the one who understands the Zulu, his response isn't exactly, to me, it doesn't go as far the other way to completely balance it. I'm seeing more negative comments being made. And then the follow-up where her fear is she's rewarded for, not rewarded, her fear comes true. She's afraid of them, and then they assault her, and she's afraid for her safety and her life. And I feel like when she leaves the camp, what we're left with is, yes, okay, these people are frightening. They're going to war. We're all going to die. Look how savage they are. Like, that to me, I take more of a negative message from that. It starts off good, and I just feel like even Jack Hawkins, who's like, no, no, they're good people. And then he gets so panicked. He's like, run for your lives, everyone. And he starts screaming, and I'm like, right, okay, so this probably isn't as balanced as it would like to be.
I mean, appreciate you. I take your point. I think for me, it's her reaction and there is mirrored by what happens to her in the hut, where the British soldiers rip her dress. And, you know, for me, the film is showing, look, this is war, and these are, you know, these are warriors, fighters. This is a scary situation where the innocent and defenseless are in danger from both sides because it's war.
Okay, it's already briefly come up, but David, how do you think the film approaches the topic of colonialism and imperialism? How does it deal with it?
So I think it is disapproving. I think the approach it takes, as I think I've already said, is one of the confusion of the ordinary man. And I think in a way it kind of ducks imperialism to a degree, if I'm critical, that there is a feeling of, look, ordinary people far away in a foreign land, really not sure why and what they're fighting for. And there is a bit of a tendency you see in quite a few places in a few national histories. I could mention one, but I'm not going to, of a rather dishonest popular history. Look, about victimology, it's not my history, mate. They made me do it. It was the rich guys, or it was this other nation that forced me into it. So I think there's a bit of that in it. But I think his attitude basically was, in several cases, Hook cries, what am I doing here? You know, ordinary soldiers, people press ganged into war by poverty or the ruling classes. The surgeon says, damn you, child, and your butchers, which I think is bizarre. I mean, you chose to be an army doctor rather than a village doctor.
Yep.
What are you complaining about? War for crying out loud. At the end, Chard says, I feel ashamed. And you feel it's partly that's about all these people that he's just killed in the war, but also the pointlessness of the fighting. Baxter, this is a butcher's yard. I came to build a bridge. The attitude is one of anti-war and anti-imperialism and colonialism. What are we doing here? There's no point to this. But nonetheless, and then there's another conversation which says, why us? And he says, well, why us? Because we're allowed, just us. You know, it's a bit of an epic line, actually. They're there. They're soldiers. Their duty is to fight, and so they fight. But they don't really know why they're doing it, and they're not quite sure they're doing it in a good cause.
So I completely agree. I do have some other points that I'm going to add, but that all comes across evidently in the film. And I have no issue with that being a message in the film. I just feel like with this very specific war and then the surrounding events around this battle, there is no wider picture of this conflict. And thus, like you say, it seemingly takes all the blame off of these individuals. So they seemingly have no authority over their own actions. It takes away Chelmsford and all the others who were making these terrible decisions, so that you can't really be against the British. You're still always on their side, even if you know they maybe shouldn't be here. And to me, it has an opportunity to be really critical and chooses to pull all of those punches and then can just give you a story that everyone can get behind, which is like, oh, we shouldn't be here and we shouldn't really be fighting, but it's not our fault and we did our best. And we respected our enemy and they respected us. So let's just recognize this for the good and the bad, rather than being like genuinely critical. I see all the points I can hear it throughout the film, and it's recognizable that the film doesn't agree with colonialism and isn't supportive of it. But it just frustrates me that its message isn't louder.
You need to be you need to be watching a different film, not Zoom.
Agreed. Now,
what's the, you know, this is a war movie, an action movie. What's the point if you think they're all worms? Well, die! Die, no, you cloninists!
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Burn! You know, I mean, they have, the message is sotto voce, because otherwise you don't have a film or a bunch of people to identify with. At least it doesn't glorify imperialism. It doesn't glorify war.
Agreed. And this is why, you know, overall, I come out kind of right in the middle, because it does a bunch of good things. And for the time as well, it does things better than I thought it would. But I just think if we, as we continue to kind of venerate this film, there has to be considerations as time passes. And that consideration can be that we don't blame the film necessarily for things. That's maybe not, I'm not furious at the film. It doesn't make me angry to watch. But the more I learn about the history and some of the historical records that have come out since, the more I just want people to know around about the, like, the wider picture of what's going on. So you can consider Zulu, you know, as a film, as a piece of entertainment, and as a moment of British history, you know, with greater understanding.
We judge it differently, certainly, yeah, now than we did. I mean, the thing that got me about the film, essentially, was I expected to go to it and think, oh, this is terrible, you know, now that our attitudes towards the empire and colonialism has changed, I'm really going to hate this. I'm going to feel very uncomfortable. I didn't. And I thought that was really interesting. I take your point that, you know, we need to talk about all these things around colonialism. That needs to be part of our national history and understood. But as a film, I didn't feel uncomfortable that this was glorifying things that now we realize are very questionable. I just thought it was a damn good movie. A bit out of date in the battle scenes.
Yeah, I would generally agree. I'm going to deliver the bit of history during this bit as well, just to kind of back up my point. But for me, it's the, and I guess, like you say, it's criticizing the film for something that, you know, it's not trying to do. But while I'm watching this, I'm also thinking about the wider context of the war. The film is about these injured British troops in this tiny outpost, and they don't want to be there. And this overwhelming army of Zulus has come to destroy them. It doesn't factor in that the British waged war on the Zulu first, and that the Battle of Isandlwana, where they were defeated, was the Zulu outmaneuvering the British and Chelmsford's kind of terrible attack. And then, obviously, you know, the Zulu continue on in the conflict. But to me, it just not even settling in and really recognizing that the British were there to force the Zulu out of their land and kill them, and then have the British be the ones who are besieged by this overwhelming enemy. There's a slight power imbalance there. The fact that they don't really show Isandlwana at all, A, because it was a terrible British defeat, so no one ever wants to remember or talk about it, and B, because it showed that we kind of instigated a lot of this. So there's that. I'm torn on the Zulu salute at the end. I think it's kind of the perfect ending for this film, and I can see the thought process behind it. But it's definitely frustrating to think that we started this war, and then the reward for it was that all the people who lived there that we went there to kill turned around and said, job well done, you're amazing.
Well, of course, the Zulus were no spring chickens when it came to invading other peoples.
No, agreed. And ultimately, it ends up being like a, you know, tit for tat, who did this, who did that. So I don't want to worry too much about, you know, who's good in war. But, you know, ultimately, like, we didn't really need to be there. And I don't know, it's just discussions about, like, the Boers are discussed in the movie, and they talk about how the Zulu are their natural enemy, which is already a bit, I'm like, you moved there in like the 17th century and then you started war with these people, and the Boers are there helping the British, but the British were at war with the Boer as well, and they forced them out of their land, which forced them more into the Zulu land. So there's just this wider picture of what happens like directly before the movie. And then I'll bring it up now because I might as well. Did you read about this book?
No.
That came out?
Probably not.
So there was this book called Zulu Victory that was written by two retired British officers. where they had found all of these letters and journal entries from soldiers in the battle. And I guess this must have happened in... So it's published in 2002, so it's fairly recent history. So this is not a criticism of the film. But all of these entries revealed that after the battle, the British went around the battlefield and murdered 500-plus wounded Zulu that were lying on the battlefield. They strung them up and hung them. They buried them alive in pits, and they stabbed them to death. And, you know, this is, you know, this is war. And, you know, the Zulu, you know, eviscerated everybody at Isandlwana. So I'm not trying to be like, oh, well, you know, one's good, one's evil. But it's hard for me to watch this film now, knowing that, you know, at the end of the battle, it, you know, the film ends with this big salute and everyone's like, ah, oh, they're respecting fellow braves. This is wonderful. And you walk out of the cinema smiling, and then you know that the relief force arrived. They walked out onto the field and they killed more Zulu that were wounded than had died during the battle by committing this atrocity.
It's clearly an atrocity, yeah.
Now, obviously, this is this one book's opinion, you know, and I've read about it from this article in The Guardian. I haven't read the book myself. I think it's just there's a lot of troubling history that's happening at this time with this conflict. So I'm reluctant to be too positive or too inspired by this excellent, you know, last stand, of which it was a military success. I just I'm torn on how to feel about the, you know, more Victoria Crosses were given out at this battle than any other in British history. That's obviously a fact. I just feel uncomfortable knowing that then all of the wounded are butchered on the battlefield. It's just like, oh yeah, that leaves a real bad taste in your mouth.
Well, I couldn't agree more, yeah.
Anyway, okay, on to, you know, other things, so we can keep it lighthearted.
Apart from the slaughter of 500, wounded warriors.
David, if you were in a battle and you had to sing a song to inspire your troops and to, you know, rally against your opponent, what would, if you just had to, someone turned to you and they were like, David, you've got the pipes, give it to them, and you've got to inspire everyone around you, what would you sing?
Okay, well, I think this might be a similar conversation. Iron Man has struggled with this question, it has to be said, Wolf. And I think it's kind of a similar question to what should the England football and rugby teams sing before a match to get away from the god-awful God Save Our Queen or whatever she is, which is anyway a UK anthem rather than an English one. So I decided I would look at it in that way. And of course, as you know, the greatest national anthems, which are there supposed to be inspiring and martial, are in reverse order, the Marseillaise, the Soviet anthem, whichever it is. And the best, of course, is Land of My Fathers. So I think Land of My Fathers would be the one. Although, the other competitor, of course, is Jerusalem, which is the national anthem, but is the one that, of course, England should sing before their matches.
See, my thought process went completely differently. And I was like, what happens if this happened tomorrow? And somebody just grabbed me and they were like, start singing, man. And of course, the first, there's no way I'll be able to, you know, think about what's going to pop into my head.
Before you answer this question, it's going to be Iron Maiden, isn't it? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's probably going to be somebody like ABBA.
Well, Dancing Queen. Come on, guys.
I was thinking SOS because I probably didn't want to be there.
It's not that encouraging, is it, SOS?
No, but it could be a more encouraging one. But I think my point is the first song that just pops into my head, and it's got to be a popular one so that everyone else can join along. It's going to be something terrible, I'm sure.
Right. Well, I just remember if I'm fighting for my life against 4,000 warriors, I won't ask you to sing.
You'll just hear me across the battlefield, a solo rendition of the Spice Girls' When Two Become One.
Yeah, well, maybe that would be inspiring in a different way. I'm not quite sure.
I don't know. Maybe it would work.
Yeah, okay. A bit more original than Land of My Fathers anyway, you know.
So just kind of as we wrap up on the film, I think this film has a cultural legacy attached to it. Maybe you disagree because you remember it slightly differently. But I just wanted to clarify, do you think that it still deserves the reputation that it has cultivated and the kind of reputation that meant that it played continually in cinemas for 12 years. This may be the greatest kind of British war movie.
No, I don't, to be honest. I mean, interesting enough, I haven't beaten a path to its door, irrespective of history and Technicolor, for 20 years or whatever. And therefore, although I know it's got this reputation, it hasn't really done it for me. I have to say, this time round, I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. And the more I've thought about it, as we've discussed today, actually, the better I have regarded it. So I was quite
interested
about how I reacted to it, because I didn't expect to be honest. So I don't think it's that, this greatest war movie ever made. I think it's a bit hammy in places and it's a bit cliched in places. And it doesn't, I don't think it's lasted that well just because of the realism you now get in movies. But I think it's a damn good movie. And I think it's got the right instincts and the right heart to it. Surprising for its time. And I think the cinema, the environment they're in, and the way they show it is just, and the sounds, the music and the singing is just fantastic.
I kind of understand its reputation and I can see how it earned it at the time. I mean, it is epic in every sense of the word. I can't even imagine what it would have been like to go see when it came out in the cinema for the first time. Queues around the block. It would have been incredible to be a part of that. But, like we said, I am less interested in it as the years go by, and it's probably not going to be one that particularly, is close to my heart.
Yeah.
Okay, David, super quick wrap up on some of the history points so that we have like an overview. There are quite a lot of inaccuracies with this film in general. But that being said, I think that the film achieves really good sense of place, a pretty good understanding of the battle and the people involved, and it feels kind of as close to a cinematic version of what happened as you're going to get. That's kind of my personal opinion regarding like the tactics and the feel of being in the environment. In reality, the real location was two very small hills and was completely unimpressive. So they navigated slightly further away to the incredible, backdrop that they use with the Drakenberg Mountains. So I applaud that, because we don't want to see the real location if it's boring.
Yeah.
A bunch of the characters were different in real life, so I thought this was interesting. The color sergeant was this tiny little man called the Kid, who was rake thin. Yeah, apparently he was incredibly skinny and he was 24 years old and everyone called him the Kid.
Didn't even have nothing chopped.
I'm going to guess no, but I can't remember what I read.
Piercing blue eyes.
Possibly. Sweet Hookie was an exemplary soldier. He had a perfect
really
military record.
Him, yeah.
He was teetotal. And when one of the things that I'm sure we both read, his daughter walked out of the film premiere so upset by how they portrayed him in the film.
Yeah.
Otto Witt, the missionary that I'm not particularly fond of, not only did he not oppose British military action, obviously, as you can kind of maybe infer from the movie, he leased Rorke's Drift to Lord Chelmsford, specifically to use at his disposal in the war against the Zulu. So, okay, maybe classic missionary there.
Yes.
As we talked about, you talked about the kind of how over the top the Welshness is, not to be, disparage the Welsh. So Stanley Baker was Welsh, which I think is why, and he was really proud of it. And, then he teams up with Richard Burton and he's like, please come and do the narration for this movie. So they're kind of pushing that. But the unit was the Warwickshire unit at the time. And 2 years later, it became the Breckens, maybe, or the South Wales. So at the time that this battle took place, it was mostly English and Irish troops in the unit, and thus they wouldn't have sung the song that they did because that wasn't their anthem. So these are not criticisms, but just interesting observations. It's obvious, but just in case anybody didn't realize, there was no battlefield singing and there was no honorary salute at the end. it seems to be that this relief force of British troops arrived, and the Zulu took a tactical retreat. They could see them coming, and you know, it wasn't worth it. So, you know, they moved off. And we've talked about the butchering. But the film can't be blamed for that, because it didn't, I don't think anybody knew at the time. I think it was generally, the book claims it was covered up a lot by the government. So, in conclusion, while the history isn't exactly accurate, it does everything it needs to for the type of film that it's making. And since it's inspired by Westerns, it does feel like a Cowboys and Indians film. So I don't want to be too critical, because it, you know, it does what it says on the tin.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. It makes sort of the sort of changes that were required in the interest of drama, I suppose, is the thing.
Yeah. And it's a movie where the opening title card is giant block letters filled with burning fire. It's giving you that kind of a movie. And despite everything I've said, that is what it's going to do. And that's kind of why we love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. You're not going to give it the highest historical accuracy score, but nor are you going to murder it, because, you know, it gets the basics right.
Hookie, the actor, never once went to the location in South Africa for the shooting. He did every one of his scenes in Twickenham.
Because, is that right? Good Lord.
Yeah, but they filmed, because the inside of the hospital and like the internal scenes were all filmed at Twickenham, and then all the external right. shots were done on location. So, and then it made me realize that you never see him outside of the hospital, I don't think. Like, or maybe he just emerges onto the roof that one time.
Mm.
And as a result, like he never filmed on location, which just seemed, in my mind, the whole thing is just there and built.
It's an outrage, isn't it? I mean, filmmakers are such liars, aren't they?
Cheats,
they're completely
and scoundrels.
Cheats and scoundrels and cads. Completely and utterly outrageous. I'm going to cancel Zulu.
We better cancel this podcast.
We better add.
So, David, as a film, what would you rate it out of 10?
7.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking like 5/6. I think it depends on my mood at the time.
Right.
You know, perfectly entertaining, but just, I don't know. It's a bit repetitive, drags on a little bit.
It drags on a little bit. It's why I'm not giving it more, yes.
And then history-wise, again, I was thinking like 5.
I mean, quite harsh. I gave it a bit more, just I gave it 7. Just I'm happy to be talked out of it, because it seemed to me it got the big things right. It's the bits around the edges that...
Yes, okay, yeah.
I'm there for you.
Okay,
know,
sort of. 6/7.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you want to be, you can be quite critical of the history. But I think you can't, kind of considering when it's made, everything else, I don't want to be too harsh.
Mm-hmm.
Were you pleased that you watched it?
Yeah, it was actually. It grew on me over time.
If someone had never seen it before,
mm.
and they weren't going back for a rewatch, would you recommend that they watch this?
I mean, yes. You know, there are worse ways of spending a couple of hours. If somebody said to me, look, I want to see a really great war movie full of heroism and, you know, inspiration, I'd say better go and watch Master and Commander then.
Yep.
Not Zulu, you know, but, you know, it is a good movie. I would say to somebody it's worth seeing it for various reasons we've discussed. What about you?
I would say if they showed any hesitation and were like, oh, should I watch it or not? I can't decide. Then I'd be like, no, don't bother.
Right.
But, you know, if you're excited and interested in, you know, all these British war movies, then sure. I mean, it's very British.
Yeah.
And you can get a lot of enjoyment out of that. I know you said some of them are cliches, but some of that stuff is the most enjoyable part of the movie.
Chard is very amusing, actually. I mean, it's got to be said, you know, okay. I mean, it is laden with cliches. But Michael Caine is bloody good, isn't he? I mean, he really is good. He does the English arse officer, you know, brilliantly. And Baxter does the honest engineer perfectly as well, you know. And there's the whole, you know, the chemistry between them about who's the boss and who's going to take control. And, you know, it'd been decent of you to ask me, pal, or something like that. I mean, all that stuff, if you like that sort of old British movie stuff, is great. It's a hoot.
Good. And with that, I think we're done.
Okay, I don't know what we're going to do next week, actually, Wolf, but everybody out there will be the first people to know.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you for today, David. I've enjoyed this.
Yes, it was very good indeed. Very interesting.
I'm sure everyone will have comments. So yes. If you do, please go to the Facebook group and tell me why I'm wrong or why I'm possibly maybe
yeah,
right.
Yeah, why you're right. Indeed. Absolutely right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And join us on Facebook.
Bye.
Bye.
Are you not entertained?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.